from Henslow Studios in Dublin, welcome to Mother Folklore, the podcast of words, Irish, Irish words, words from Ireland. I'm Darragh O'Shea.
I'm Geraldine McAvoy.
And we're delighted today to be joined by a very special guest. He is well known to you all as the senior film critic of the Irish Times.
That'll do.
He is, of course, Donald Clark. Faultig a Mother Folklore, Donald. Hi, Donald.
Hello.
Donald, you have written wonderfully and very interestingly about film for years, and as well you've also in your column written about a range of other topics, one of which is something that's been that's very interesting to us as a podcast about language, which is the idea of the concept of good crack, great crack, having the crack, and how this is represented in the written word.
Yeah, well, I would probably disappoint you a little bit in that you probably expect me to sort of stampede in here and start shouting about how much I hate the damn thing. And when I say the damn thing, I mean C-R-A-I-C. Mm-hmm. Well, look, we're going to have trouble in this conversation saying what we mean, aren't we? Kind of making this distinction. Anyway, but in the...
We'll refer to them as C-K and I-C.
I'll have a go at trying to keep it up. Yeah, sure. And expect me to say that I think that crack... C-R-A-I-C, yeah. It should be banished from all English usage, which I don't think, because I obviously I do accept the fact that usage is kind of king in these situations. Mm-hmm. And we have got to the stage now where the Irish spelling, if we can call it that, is now far more commonly used in English usage than C-R-A-C-K. So I would grudgingly admit that that is the usage that isn't here now and is probably going to stick. There isn't in the Irish Times actually an entry in the style book, probably because the style book was, was last written when this book wasn't, the final, last version of the style book wasn't completed when this was already a live issue. But I know that this sprung up recently. For example, I think it was Roisin Ingle actually. We had a conversation with an editor and they said, well, actually the general usage in the Irish Times is C-R-A-C-K. Mm. And she sort of said, wow, is this possible? Isn't it? And this whole conversation started up again. But to get around to the point I was getting up there slowly, is that obviously I accept the fact that that is now the usage, most common usage, and therefore I can't reasonably object to anyone writing it thus, either formally or in social media or wherever. What does bug me, and this really does bug me, is the perception that's got around that C-R-A-I-C is correct in inverted commas, mm-hmm. that it is the original correct and uncorrupted version of that word, and that anybody who insists upon or even just writes or occasionally uses C-R-A-C-K is a big fat West Brit and is anglicising and appropriating a good old traditional Irish word. Mm. And the point, which we're obviously going to dance around this throughout the rest of the conversation, I have to stress to people, is that the usage C-R-A-I-C in English, and I make this point forcefully, in English, was almost unheard of until as late as the late 1980s, early 1990s. Mm-hmm. If you, I take as my Rosetta Stone here, the Christy Moore's The Crack Was 90 in the Isle of Man, which, whenever it appears in an album, was C-R-A-C-K, right up until the 1980s, and nobody blinked an eye, nobody suggested it should be anything else. And where I first noticed it, I was probably aware of it as that spelling through Sean Ban Branagh, SBB, and he used it, but important point being, he was using it in Irish.
Yeah.
I mean, he would have used the Irish version of helicopter or, whatever the word might be when speaking in Irish as well. But that became kind of a catchphrase of his. I don't actually remember it appearing promiscuously in English until, I would say, obviously, you can find examples of it, I'm sure, in the 70s, 80s, even 60s, but promiscuously and as the most commonly used form until as late as 1990 and the World Cup of that year.
Yeah.
When I was living in London at the time, and it's interesting, that's where I first saw it, that you'd suddenly, it was starting appearing on blackboards outside pubs, trying to lure you in to watch whatever the match was that day, with promise of crack or kill. Well, let's kill, I suppose, given the World Cup was on.
Yeah.
But promising you with crack. And it got to this extent, the weird extent where there was a pub in King's Cross, which was then called, and is now called again, the Charles I on North Down Street, where we used to drink quite a bit. And it was sort of a kind of Irish pub. But they had a competition to rename the pub at one stage, and it ended up being called, for a while, the Crack House, C-R-A-I-C-H, which was, in fact, apparently fantastically poor taste, because King's Cross at that stage was, less so now, it's been more gentrified, was, you know, a lot of people using, you know, crack cocaine in that area. So given that was the reference, it was rather poor taste. A lot of sex workers around there, and drug issues with the sex workers. Anyway, that's a whole different issue. But that was, but what that recognized, and I think by this stage we're getting to about 94, 95 with that, was that it was wound up with the whole, the rise in the kind of bottled Irish pub. It suddenly came out of nowhere in London that stage. To that point, the Irish pub was, they're generally quite disreputable, not terribly nice places. I rather liked them, but they were kind of, you know, they were sticky carpet and demographic of drinkers tended to be, you know, an average of in their 40s and 50s. And even that period, suddenly that kind of, you know, fake news, you know, fake road signs started popping up and copper kettles. And
This is before the Irish pub in With Nail and I was the pub before that.
That's a perfect example, yes. Yeah, the pub there where they meet Dara O'Malley, is that his name? They meet the Irishman that he threatens. That's exactly what they were like. But it was all, the rise of that word seemed to be part of that movement. And to finish off this lengthy point I'm making, why I keep writing about this is there seems to be a lot of people, and it's a generational thing, seem completely baffled to learn this fact, that in fact this, that as the commonly used English version in English, it's a phenomenon that is far more recent than people imagine. Many people imagine.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, but there's a wonderful account on Twitter, Northern Ireland Girl 81, in which a woman called Brona. Brona from Newry. She basically tweets entries from her diary from when she's 12 or 13 years old, which is around the time of the hunger strikes. And it's a phenomenal piece of social history to actually intersect her obsession with the charts while mentioning these things that were going on. And when one day she mentions, that they herself and her friends had good crack. And she spells it with a CK.
Yeah. Well, you would. Well, I would say as well, in terms of the, we'll get into this, I suppose. I'm sure you know much more about this than I do. But the common theory is that it's a Northern English, Scottish word that kind of made its way via Northern territories into. One thing we haven't actually mentioned yet is that the use of the word itself, however you spell it, accelerated at the period I'm talking about as well.
Yeah.
It was a common enough word in Brona, as you say. My mum would have used it. My mum's a Ulster Protestant from Armagh, and she would certainly have used it. Now, she wouldn't have said the crack.
Yeah.
She would have said somebody was great crack. She would have said we had great crack. She would certainly have used that. Obviously, she would never have even known there was an Irish language spelling at that stage. But Brona is, I think, a good demonstration of that. Yes, it was. That's how the word was written. And there would have been an Irish language version of it when writing in Irish, which SPP would have used. But that's how I remember it.
But I wonder, the debate is whether it's C-R-A-C-K or C-R-A-C. But I wonder and which is the correct version within inverted commas. But I wonder, is the better question as the usage of it, if you're using, as I would typically use C-R-A-I-C when I'm, mostly I would say it rather than, but if I was to think about how that's spelled, it would be the AIC version. But is that an example of code switching rather than actually which is the correct version? So in my head, I'm using a word that I know exists in Irish and I'm using it for a very specific purpose. So there's a bunch of research behind code switching and it's very often done for a purpose. So you select that word for a reason. And it sometimes can be political. You see Donald Trump doing it a lot when he will code switch with an inverted commas. He'll use a Spanish word for a very deliberate reason and he sort of does a mocking accent along with that. And that portrays something very obvious. But when I use it, I mean a very specific thing. You mean a very specific type of fun that I would associate usually with Ireland. And to me, that is more akin to code switching rather than I'm using a specific word that is spelled this way and this is the only way to spell it. And sorry, for people who don't understand, code switching is like, it's where you take specific words out of a different language and you use them in the common, so say I'm speaking English and I will switch to, put in an Irish word and then continue speaking English. Usually, I wouldn't code switch with somebody, say, who didn't speak Irish or didn't have an understanding of Irish. Usually you code switch with somebody who understands some of the language that you're code switching into. So for me, that's where the distinction is. So when I'm using C-R-A-I-C, it's a code switch thing. It's not this is the only way to spell it. Like, I don't care when people spell C-R-A-C-K, But when I use it that way, it's because I'm using the word from Irish.
Same way, yeah. If I was referred to someone in English, oh, he's a bit of a buchal donna. Like the fact bold boy would not sound in English would sound preposterous.
In
those cases. But the another thing, and maybe actually there is cracks, C-R-A-C-K, and the Irish word kind of almost coexisted as separate entries, which are just eventually overlapped. And this is why I bring in what I would refer to as the Mumbai defense.
Right.
Which is the idea that maybe C-R-A-C-K, C-R-A-C-K spelling, and I've done some, when I initially went into Irish newspaper archives, which is because there's no treasury of Hiberno English, which has been a huge loss to academia in Ireland, Irish newspaper archives is probably the closest thing to that. The word crack, obviously, because it has so many uses, you can't just search it on its own.
Yeah, yeah.
And when I search the word C-R-A-I-C, because the old fonts in the newspapers from the 19th century, you get the name Craig too much.
Right.
What I did, I looked up good crack and great crack.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then what I found then was the entries in the 1890s almost always came for good crack, almost always came from court reports.
Okay.
Right. In which case, and they were court reports typically from the northwest of Ireland. So someone in Sligo, there'd be a court report where Sean and Mike, you know, they're having great crack, and then Sean hit Mike with a bottle.
Right. Yeah.
You know, there was an argument over the sale price of a horse, and it was all good crack until someone gave someone a dig, and these were typically reported by a journalist, you know, a literate journalist reporting from an area of a mixed language area, putting these things in as court reporters are wanted to do, putting these things in inverted commas, comic effect.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. This is a tradition that lives on to this very day.
This is a colloquial term used to describe having a good time, often accompaniment of alcohol. That sounds like it makes sense. I mean, I think it's also what's happened in England and outside Ireland is it's a way of demonstrating how much you know about Ireland. And there's a great kind of as someone once pointed out, there's no better way of attracting attention to yourself on Twitter or getting replies than making an error. I mean, you're far more likely to people correct you than yell at you if you say something that they think is, you know, politically wrong or immoral. And there's a whole industry, I think, of people out there who say, you'll find you're wrong in spelling a C-R-A-C-K. Actually, in Ireland, of course, they spell a C-R-A-C, and I happen to know this because I met an Irish person once. But there's a great deal of that goes on, I think, as well. I can remember, there is now, I would say, occasionally some mischievousness about this. I did an interview with the guys from the Young Offenders few years ago, and the word crept up in the conversation, and being a belligerent person over a certain age, as we've established, it's to a certain extent a generational thing. I spelled it C-R-A-C-K in the copy, and my editor left it thus, he shall remain nameless, lest he gets death threats. But I noticed he did one of the pull quotes, which is the quote you put larger letters in the middle of these. He put the word crack in it, and I think that was a mischievous attempt. And sure enough, you get all these sort of tweets from people with GIFs of people sighing or GIFs of people putting their head in their hands, saying, oh, it's spelt C-R-A-I-C-K, not C-R-A-C-K. How could you not know this?
Did somebody include a GIF of Michael Jackson eating popcorn?
No. You're right to bring that up. Yes, the GIFs that make you bang your head against the wall that you've seen, so that's certainly up there with them. And Stephen Colbert doing the same thing, yes. I can't remember which head in the hands ones they are, but there's two or three of not this again sort of GIFs, which pops up with that. So I think a lot of people really quite, I mean, we're to a certain extent doing it now. We're kind of having fun teasing out our own opinions about this, but it is one of those things people love to know about in inverted commas and get a chance to correct people on in social media. But I mean, I'm interested. I mean, the thing that we've sort of touched on but haven't gone into in depth yet as I said, the very fact that the word itself became emblematic of something and was used so much more in public discourse and in print from a point about 30 years ago, and it became a way of it became emblematic of a new version of Irishness, I think. Then, which, I mean, I don't think enough's been written about that really interesting period between 1989 and 1995-96, when, as I mentioned earlier on, it was demonstrated through pubs. But you could trace it from My Left Foot through The Commitments, through Italian 90, Riverdance, whatever we think about Riverdance, was incredible kind of thing to happen at that point. And that whole stretch when Ireland suddenly became much more visible on the cultural stage.
I connect it. I actually would, when I look at that period, and I'm old enough to remember this, Garaging isn't, but I think it starts at Live Aid.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
I think it starts with Live Aid, with the Give Us Your Fucking Money, with Bono.
Yeah,
suddenly,
that's a fair point, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think there was a point when in some ways that Irishness suddenly was marketed first as a kind of a historically innocent version of whiteness.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this kind of large, and this kind of, that was very much, that was a huge part of Live Aid, which I always think Jeremy Paxman described Live Aid as the first draft of New Labour. And yeah. I've never been able to forget that quote.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
It means everything and it means nothing. It's just one of these wonderfully kind of opaque kind of.
Yes. Yeah. It's platitudes on a global scale.
But ultimately consumer driven reform.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think that does make sense, and certainly Bob, that version of Bob Geldof represents very much the sort of Irishness that became in vogue during the period I'm talking about, which doesn't really have a name, that period, because we're talking about a pre-Celtic Tiger or the beginnings of Celtic Tiger. Yeah. I mean, that then blended into the economic revolution, which obviously had its upsides and its downsides, which we all know that came afterwards. But yeah, you're quite right. That version of Bob Geldof, cutting through the crap, those sort of cliches.
It was, and I do think the fact that Bono chose not to move to London or LA and actually stayed in Ireland was a huge part of the turning point, that suddenly rich successful Irish people were staying in Ireland, and then Ryanair becoming following that this was the idea that, and a big part of the Celtic Tiger was that rich people weren't leaving Ireland anymore, and this was, and that led to those other economic concerns, but then the idea of Ireland being a great fun venue, not just there's a shift in the approach of tourism, and around Italian 90 there was a shift in the perception of Irish people. I have issues with the best fans in the world thing, particularly because I think the fact this expression happened just around the time of Hillsborough, which was a year before 1919. And you say, like every parent knows, and you tell one child they're the best person in the world, you're making a comment about the other child. It was clear, very directly used. The best fans in the world thing was very much a comment on British fans.
Yeah, yeah.
That was disguised as a compliment. That wasn't really a compliment at all to Irish fans.
Well, I never thought of that before, but that's actually so, because I mean, I wasn't born in 1990, so that's probably why. But like, that's really true that, you know, if you're saying that, oh, Irish fans are the best fans in the world, and you see that now even when we kind of, I think it's marketed quite well when we go to things that we don't perform very well at, like the Euros or the Rugby World Cup, we'll see. you know, and there's other groups of fans who are behaving very well, but we just kind of market it quite well that, oh, we're the best fans in the world. They cleaned up the stadium. Like, so did other people, you know, or they're singing on a train, bothering a nun, you know. It's presented in such a way that, you know, other fans aren't great. And that might be true, but particularly when it's presented in that way of Hillsborough, like, there's something that doesn't sit quite well with that.
Well, we are very convinced of the fact that everyone loves us.
Yes.
And to be fair, I mean, that came after a very difficult time, a period when it was very difficult to be Irish, particularly. We're talking about a period when the peace process began to set in, as you know, which another version of Hillsborough became significant. But that came after a period when being Irish in London, being Irish in England, was associated. You were constantly in a position where you had to apologise for, people being blown up in Enniskillen or being blown up in the City of London or wherever it might be. So it was understandable that there was kind of a slightly unhealthy and over-enthusiastic embrace of the fact that, oh, geez, everyone loves us, we're great, and everyone loves us in that period.
I can really see that. I mean, you were living in London in the early 90s, I imagine, and it's something that yes, like when something positive about Ireland comes along, it'd be hard not to embrace it.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean, it was. I mean, this is a big topic, but you know, there was. You did encounter a lot of class was an issue in this as well. Sure. You know, I mean, there was always perception that you know that I was a sort of, I don't know how you put it, sort of you know, well spoken, middle class version Irish sort of fellow.
Yeah.
And we were sort of exempt from that to the taxi driver rants to a certain extent.
You're on the Dave Allen level. You're fine.
Well, that puts it quite well. Yes. Well, exactly. Well, that's. I mean, again, talking about the Irish in England, that's you raise an interesting point with the likes of Dave Allen. There was that long tradition of the urbane Irishman on a stool on a night entertainment show, which Terry Wogan was part, and no harm to Terry Wogan, he was kind of a genius. But Val Dunican would be another example, you know, that Henry Kelly, not quite on the same level. But yeah, there was that tradition of kind of the urbane Irishman in a cardigan and on a stool at with perhaps one or two glasses of something beside him, but no more than that, who was also exempt from. You know, the largely exempt from the racist kickback against the violence at that time.
And he was particularly interesting because he focused so much on his routine was, I'm slagging around, but it's okay because I'm Irish. Mm. And he didn't get involved in some of the other stuff that 70s comedians did. His comic legacy probably lasted longer when a lot of those 70s comedians were being rejected wholesale in the 80s.
Oh, he was. Well, it's very interesting, Dave Allen, because if you go back and look at that stuff, is that there was two Dave Allens. There was the raconteur, and there was the sketches, and the sketches are kind of awful. And there's one or two that are kind of hung around sexual violence that are startling.
Yeah.
And when you look back now, I mean, you've got some of that in Benny Hill as well.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I think, I suppose he maybe was kind of like, you know, pushed into that because the notion of a show and he wasn't pushed into the actual material itself into content, but he was pushed into doing the sketches because the notion of a guy sitting on a chair for 40 minutes just doing a monologue didn't sound like a light entertainment, still doesn't, frankly, sound like a light entertainment show.
He'd have been a massive star in the podcast era if he had been born a few decades later.
That's right, yeah. No, he had the... Well, there was, I mean, I think that...
I'm reminded, you know, the way the young ones had to stick in those musical interludes because just the BBC formatting was, this is a variety show, technically it's a sketch, and same way I think that, I'm sure if Dave Allen had his way, there wouldn't have been any sketches at all.
I suspect not. No. Well, but you talk about that generation and the podcast, The Rocketeer, but that was the era of the long form chat show interview. And there were a whole bunch of those people who could just sit there and do 40, 50 minutes on Parkinson, David Niven, Peter Ustinov. You know, all those guys, I mean, like, they were wheeled out and you know, then you had the more volatile versions like Oliver Reed. But but those guys, they could do 90 minutes of just chat. That, as you say, that they could do a whole series of podcasts just of their anecdotes.
Just, like, I know, and Richard Harris is a great guest as well, but whenever someone was talking too much, was telling too many stories when we were young, my dad was always saying, oh, your man thinks he's Peter Ustinov.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he was just the anecdote man.
Well, there's an episode of, I think it's the television version of Knowing Me, Knowing You, when they have this pretentious... Well, it's one of those interesting incidents, actually, when you're kind of on Alan's side, but they have this appalling, pretentious French chef on. And at one point he asks Alan who his favourite philosopher is, and he sort of pauses and goes, Peter Ustinov. So he was at the Middlebrow's favourite philosopher at that point.
There was another one. I was looking up other entries for Good Crack and Great Crack. I came across an entry from the Sunday Independent in the 1910s, and in which a writer from the North is reviewing a book. It was about country life, and it said, this book really proves what I've been trying to say for all is that, you know, you need to get out of the city to have a good conversation, or, as we call it, where I come from up north, a good crack.
Right.
Crack. A good crack, so it's, he uses the nondescript article.
Yeah, a noun. Yeah, the idea that a crack is a kind of a noun as opposed to crack being this abstract form.
But then you describe it with the definitive article. You talk about the crack, but you wouldn't say I had a crack. It's just crack in general.
Well, we've got away from the fact that actually, I don't know if the words are related, they most certainly are, but you would still use a crack as a joke. As a synonym for a joke.
Ah, I took a crack at him. Yeah, right, sure.
I think that I would say that's a kind of a slightly it definitely exists. And someone says, "Oh, he had a great crack." You know, that Frank Carson had a couple of good cracks there.
Yeah.
And I think that though that usage kind of slid a little bit. But I think the idea, in this case, what they're saying is, in the 1910s version, that a good crack was a really, really good conversation when no one's in a hurry.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure.
And this is the thing, that crack kind of stopped being this name, but then the crack has come back as a kind of going out for a night and having lots of fun. That is a recent usage. It's almost the name dropped and it came back.
Yes. Well, that notion of the crack as again, it's one of those things that we've gotten the impression that everyone has been forever has been saying, like, do you like the crack? Are you having the crack?
Yeah.
And it's sort of, I mean, there's a certain extent to which this there's a kind of self-imposed stage Irishness about this, is that kind of, we've got the stage now where some of this language is paddywhackery that we invented for ourselves when we've got used in the past to Americans doing this on our behalf.
Yeah.
But now we're doing some of this stuff ourselves.
Mm-hmm. It's a funny thing. And I think in some ways the self-driven paddywhackery is possibly its corrective, because when Americans were talking, when we met Americans in the 80s, they talk about stuff about purple moons and green clovers. And I was like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
I mean, and then it turned out there was an ad on television that had something to do with purple moons and Irish. I think it may have been an ad for Lucky Charms.
Lucky Charms, right?
Which we don't get here.
Oh, that's right. Of course, they have the purple moons in them, don't they? Yes, they do. Yeah.
And then they had some other things, and corned beef was a big thing that they were.
Corned beef and cabbage, yes.
Yeah, I had that on St. Patrick's Day in America when I was there, and I was like, "What is this? It's gross."
No, but I can remember being when I lived in New York for a year, and I was working in a bar, and people just sort of said, like, "Oh," they were being nice. They were saying, like, "So you must eat plenty of corned beef and cabbage." Why?
Yeah.
I mean, as far as we were concerned, then as now, corned beef was something that came in cans.
Yeah, sliced meat your dad eats.
when there was nothing left in the cupboard when you were a student. Oh, God, we're stuck with that can of corned beef we bought in Quinsworth 2 months ago. And this notion that it was a delicacy. But I'm very interested in that notion of the Irish-American caricature of Irishness. And it's always important not to be too, savage and nasty about this. These are well-meaning people, and they're making a genuine attempt to celebrate their culture. But what I'm always interested, and I've talked to Americans about this, is there an equivalent of this outside Irish-American communities in the United States? And I don't actually think there is. The closest, I don't know if you'd agree, I think the closest community to the Irish in America is probably the Italians in America.
Yes.
That they're Catholics and that the wave of immigration came at much the same sort of period. They tend to go to the same places. You know, they live next door to one another in New York City and Chicago and places like that. And I talked to Italian Americans about this years and years and years ago, just in that pub, not for a story or anything in there. And they're thinking, well, not really. I mean, there are things that annoy I should explain. The person I was talking to was an actual Italian who moved to America. Yeah. She was saying, well, not really to that extent. Not the notion of kind of, Lucky Charms and leprechauns and, this weird thing with Notre Dame, say it correctly, football team, with the actual whole legion of leprechauns, who are represented, represent the football team. And so, like, things like, that annoy us, spaghetti and meatballs. What the hell is that? And that's sort of presented to us as, a genuine Italian dish. And but there's not this notion of this invention. Italian American, the way there is with this invented Irish American, with all those sentimental attachments to it.
It is an interesting one, because I think there is a perception that certain Italian American dishes, and this is true of most American immigrant cuisines, and that there's a version of a national dish, which, say, chop suey was invented in America as a Chinese food that was available to be sold to non-Chinese people. Corned beef and cabbage is almost certainly a version of an Irish stew when lamb wasn't available.
Yeah. Right, okay.
Yeah.
And then similarly, there's the California roll in sushi was obviously invented.
Burritos as well. They were invented in San Francisco, I think. Yeah, so then a Mexican roll.
I think pad thai as well, it was invented in the 1950s as well,
but
in Thailand after one of the Thai royal family had seen how well Chinese cuisine was doing in America. Yeah. And so there's a lot of, and you know yourself, remember when pulled pork suddenly arrived and people acted like it had always been there?
It hasn't gone away yet. It's still after 10 or 15 years since that popped up. Well, there is also the slightly tricky issue, and we probably need a culinary expert on here to flesh this. Irish cuisine is not quite as sophisticated and advanced as Italian cuisine is in the home country. They had in Italy more to bring with them, shall we put it that way?
They certainly did.
Yeah, and, I mean, I don't wish to be unkind to Boxty or Kilcannon or Champ or something else that doesn't involve a potato, but with the best will in the world, and we have excellent food here and all those things, we do not have the variety of indigenous cuisine that the Italians.
I don't know. We had what was his name?
Marcin was in while I was
out.
Marcin
was in talking to us, and he was a fascinating guest. And he would definitely disagree with you, but I think that.
Well, he probably knows. I don't know what I'm talking about. He certainly does.
Yeah, he seemed to think that he did. I mean, he played a good. We do have wonderful food here, but we don't have that culture of food. I think it was the argument he was making that we definitely don't have. And that comes from a difficult relationship with food, largely.
I'd say the best Irish food is basically very good Irish ingredients with as little interference as possible.
Yeah, exactly. But largely, I mean, globally, we're not known for our food. That's not what we're known for. We're known for crack and Guinness. What we're known for.
The crack and Guinness.
Exactly. And I think that's a really clever marketing. Like you were saying, in that period leading up to Italia 90, we were a really, it wasn't necessarily... You wouldn't be advertising the fact that you were Irish in certain places.
Sure.
You know, and then to switch that in such a way that has become such a marketable, profitable thing, in a sense, while there is negative connotations with it, it's taken too far and it gets to the point of caricature, like we were saying in the United States, to the point where it can be a little bit annoying. It's still to be able to turn it around in such a quick time. People talk about the ability that Germany has had to turn around their public image from being at the receiving end of probably one of the worst atrocities to happen in Europe in modern times. And then to turn this image around to be a very sort of trustworthy world leader in such a short time is amazing. But I think also in Ireland, the way that we've turned around from being dangerous people to being... great crack and everyone loves us. And whether or not that's true is immaterial, I think, for the marketing ability that it's had. So in a sense, I think there's something sort of admirable about that ability that we've had to sort of switch from being a very negative thing to being a very positive thing. Whether or not it's true is immaterial.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, everyone does a bit of that. Every nation does a bit of that. I mean, if they're... Germany is a different example, of course, because in that case, they weren't flogging themselves as a tourist destination.
Sure, sure, yeah.
And it wasn't a cultural thing to a large extent. And in our case, I mean, in our case, it's a massive country in European terms, and also they have enormous natural resources and all those things. So, I mean, the German economic miracle in the 1950s was an economic miracle. Obviously, we had the Celtic Tiger hit here eventually for all its demerits. But as we've already discussed, it was as much a cultural reinvention as anything in this country.
Yeah, and I do think, I mean, it's very easy to poo-poo the kind of the Celtic Tiger and the various excesses and certain gold calves that were raised. Yeah. But, I mean, it was actually a time of one of probably our greatest period of pop chart dominance.
Right. Yes.
And that. That's,
yeah. I mean, there's these strange things happened. I mean, Louis Walsh, kind of, you know, that suddenly became like the most successful music impresario in Britain, Ireland, possibly Europe.
And he had cut his teeth in backroom roles in the Eurovision for years.
Yeah.
And then I think in some ways, because there have been obviously we'd had Tin Lizzy and we'd had U2, but no one had ever incorporated little bits of Irish flutes and stuff until Westlife, Bewitched, and the Chorus. And I think the boy bands were a very new perception of the Irish male being presented to British audiences. The idea that there's an Irish man on your 12-year-old daughter's wall in your house, so you're scared.
And they were sensitive as well. The way that you didn't get from Luke Kelly. Oh, look, he was sensitive. I'm being unfair, but in a very different way. to these guys in their kind of silk shirts blowing in the wind and the pop.
They liked sitting on stools too, like Dave Allen.
They did. They stood up for them dramatically whenever you got to the middle age.
Key change, you got right up
That's
there.
That's right. I think we're talking about one thing I do think people kind of are, you know, uneasy about acknowledging is that we should mention, as a lot of this conversation has ended up being about those changes at the end of the last century, the beginning of this century, is that you had that period. I mean, I think one defining period, I think, in terms of the shift away from the church and towards a more liberal society was that I don't mind there's written a play about this, but that nail-biting 1995 divorce referendum.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, that was the, I mean, you know, that was the point at which, as you recall, I mean, it was, I don't think the lead was ever as big as the lead was in the two recent referenda on marriage equality and abortion. But it was a significant lead, and it went down and down and down and down. And it was won by kind of, you know, I think, you know,
about a percent.
Yeah.
The equivalent 100%. Of one vote per ballot box. Yeah.
And you sort of feel like, well, I mean, you know, I mean, this is making it over dramatic, you know, the whole country have reversed back to kind of, you know, that priest driven conservatism at that point. It wouldn't, of course. But nonetheless, there was a feeling there that, phew, we've just crossed kind of a Rubicon. And what I'm getting to slowly with this is that I think when people look back and they say, what the hell happened that in the space of, you know, 20 years, well, in the space of 10 years, little more than 10 years from the 1983 abortion referendum, we got that 12 years later, and then in the space of another 10 or 15 years, you had this extraordinary change where became the first country to vote in same-sex marriage by a plebiscite, and all the liberal things that happened since, and the declining power of the church. And we're both talking about how the hell that happened and how it happened so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Is people talking, interesting, I think it's a very good point to make about the introduction of free secondary education in the late 1960s, that you had a delayed response to that, mm-hmm. suddenly a lot of adults. But I think that was a little too early, really, to account for that happening then. It was a contributing factor. The thing which is difficult, which is a tricky issue for kind of like liberals, is that a large part of the fact was money arrived.
Yeah.
Sure.
And that, ironically, had a liberalizing effect. And one of the reasons the liberalizing effect was a lot of people didn't emigrate, would have emigrated, and a lot of people came back.
Yeah,
I mean, I sort of did that, but I think that was sort of an accident. I came back in 1995, which would say, look, I'm a classic example of somebody, you know, who went away for 10 years and came back when the economy improved. That actually wasn't really true. I always kind of planned to come back at that point anyway.
But I think the return.
But those things, young, educated people were suddenly about the place in larger numbers than they'd be. I mean, I can remember I would have graduated university in 1986, and looking at a friend of mine who was an architect, and he had a picture of his class from that year in UCD, and every single one emigrated bar one person.
Yeah.
And no one thought a thing about it. And that was a whole range, and it was largely the economic surge in those years that kept a lot of those people there and contributed greatly to the liberalisation I think most of us listening to this podcast will enjoy, enjoy it or appreciate it.
Mm.
I think it's a really important point. And something interesting about the divorce referendum and its passing by percentage is historians in the future will make a connection between the divorce referendum and the tribunals, particularly the amount of hidden money that was disclosed in divorces immediately afterwards,
and how
that led to Anne's Backer investigations and so other things like that.
Mm-hmm. So it was also, I think that divorce, and this is getting way off the subject here, but that was a great reference, a great example of a great warning not to pay too much heed to Jeremiah's and people speaking of disaster, because the whole thing was the country will fall apart, we'll end up with, and we ended up with the lowest divorce rate in Europe 20 years later.
I think a lot of that has to do with just how complicated divorce was. It's much easier not to do it. But that, there was those mad, I teach a class on it, and they do those, they had this mad billboards like "Bye Bye Daddy," which I don't remember the referendum, so it's mad to me. Where's your dad going? I don't understand where he's
going. Hello divorce, goodbye daddy.
I just don't understand where people thought he was going. If your dad was just going to leave and never come back after divorce, probably a shit dad anyway.
Yeah.
your life.
I finished secondary school in 1996, and I don't think any of the lads in my class are divorced. Which is it would be unheard of in a parallel class.
I'm much the same. I've got 10 years on you, a bit more actually. But someone will text me now and say, "What about me?" But I mean, of my long standing friends, well, many of whom married 20, 30 years ago. I think they're all. And it was, but you know, this was this notion that country's going to, it's going to just go over the cliff. And
we're all going to turn to Elizabeth Taylor.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, it'd be like Bel Air. Like, you know, no one can even stay married longer than 6 months.
But it's funny though, because my boyfriend's a Finn and his grandmother is like, you know, an older person. She's in her 80s and she's divorced, and she was the first old person. And this was like, I mean, we're together 7 years now, so I like, it's not that recent. And like, she was the first old person I'd met who was divorced. And for me, that was super weird. Mm. And like, sort of couldn't understand, because it's much more, I think people maybe perhaps take marriage a little bit more seriously here than in other countries. I'm not singling out Finland, but just because it's really hard to get out of it. Like, so you've got to be certain if you want to get married, because it's just a pain to get out of. Even, I mean, now it's obviously becoming easier, but I wonder, will that change and the levels of people getting married and then subsequently getting divorced?
Well, they've had a long, good whack at it now. Like, it's sort of 20, more than 20 years. But certainly, the example they could have looked to was Northern Ireland, and where divorce rate was extremely low. You know, I grew up in Belfast till I was 11, and I think of one friend of my parents who got divorced, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before we wrap up, we obviously talk a lot about the Irish language on this show, and one of the things is people talk about the kind of the usefulness of it. And a couple of years ago, you wrote an article that I've always remembered, when you were just talking about how you wrote about you did mathematics in university.
Yeah.
And you said, well, technically, people talk about how useful mathematics is, but maybe people might study because they enjoy it.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think what I was getting at there was that people strive too hard to try and come up with practical reasons why studying an academic subject may be of use to you. We can talk at great length about how, you know, it trains your mind. I mean, any academic pursuit of any sort trains your mind and hones your mind and so forth. But it's certainly, I mean, what the math thing is interesting in that people are people, and there's a certain degree of this is true with Irish as well, I think, but even more so of mathematics, and certainly less true of Irish now than it used to be. People rather boast about not being good at mathematics. In a way they would not boast about not knowing about history or literature or geography, whatever. They say, "Oh, I honestly can't add three numbers together. I'm terrible at mathematics. I'm really good for you. You're an idiot." I don't mean that if you're not good at mathematics, please. Yeah. I'm joking. But what I'm getting at is that they wouldn't sort of say, "Oh, I don't know who Napoleon is. Who's Napoleon? Who's he? You know, that was he king of Spain? I haven't a clue. Where's Barcelona? I'm not. That doesn't happen." I don't know quite why that is, but I think there is still a degree of that in Irish as well, which I know that people who write or deal about the Irish language and its position in contemporary life always like sigh when everyone says, like, it's how it's taught, you know, it's how it's taught, as if that's an excuse for anything. But I think there's a certain amount of people who kind of like rather enjoy annoying the Irish language lobby by boasting about how bad they are at it and how little they care about it.
I think that's partially our fault. We're really easy to annoy. It's really easy to piss us off.
There isn't really a maths lobby. But I think people who do have some qualification in mathematics do really kind of grind their teeth at that notion, and people kind of like, it's one of the things that people are rather proud about not knowing about. As if, I mean, partly it is that there's a notion that kind of mathematicians are all kind of, you know, people in duffel coats who've got no social skills. You know, there's a degree of that about it. And whereas it's still regarded as rather kind of romantic to know about the more obscure novels of George Eliot. It's not felt that way to know about. But anyway, go back to your question. Yeah, I mean, I think that people, when people try then to explain why they may study Irish or they may study mathematics, whatever it is, they leave out the fact that it is a pleasure in itself.
Sure. Yeah.
That I don't need to kind of, it may, very, very few occasions, it may be useful to know how to solve a linear equation. But to be honest, there's not much more than Pythagoras' theorem that you would use obviously basic arithmetic that you would use in daily life. But people do leave aside the fact that the Mass in particular is a pleasure in itself, in that, and also it has, not one of these elegant phrases, it has a kind of beauty to it, mm-hmm. In terms of how the various aspects of it knit together and how mm-hmm. it creates language.
Yeah.
That makes it worth studying on its own for that alone.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But I think it is an interesting comparison with Irish. That, I sure. mean, they are two subjects that people, if they hate them, they really hate them.
It is, and I think it's funny that some of those conversations they're both opposites. They're on opposite ends of the usefulness myth.
Yeah,
of education. Exactly, yeah.
Well, I mean, I can remember. I mean, I never did Irish because mm-hmm. I was educated in the north until I was 11 in a Protestant school. By the time I came down, I was exempt, and I wasn't taking on any more subjects than I had to. Thank yeah. you very much. Ironically, I probably thought, well, all these people who've done Irish for 7 years, obviously they've got 7 years ahead of me. And most people I would talk to this bloody word. When I actually got there and talked mm-hmm. to people in my school, that they could barely kind of ask the directions to the post office.
Was this in Limerick? Was it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. To the post office. So I kind of sat there and kind of watched all this. But it was. I mean, in retrospect, it was kind of terrible. I mean, friends of mine, did medicine and law and failed Irish, failed pass Irish, went to Trinity, having failed pass Irish, which is, I mean, kind of extraordinary. I mean, they'd, got A's and B's and everything else. And somewhere in there, something mm-hmm. had gone wrong. This is a long time ago. I don't know if this is still happening, but mm-hmm. somewhere in there, something had gone wrong. Though, of course, I mean, I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but the trendy incarnation of Irish
yeah.
that's come along in the last 10 or 15, 20 years wasn't there. Yeah. I mean, there was nothing fashionable about learning Irish at that point. Mm-hmm. That notion of it being kind of, the rather cool thing, which it is, and to a certain extent now, was a long way off.
It wasn't there at that time in the 80s in Limerick.
No, it wasn't there. I'm not the person to ask in a sense. Yeah, I wasn't learning it, but I got no sense of that at that stage. Yeah. No.
Mm-hmm. This sounds like I have a suspicion that there's a much maligned Kerry female author
might have
her name invoked.
I'm not in the position. I've avoided saying that because I've never read that particular much maligned Kerry author. Certainly any conversation that I had that I heard about people and their lack of enthusiasm for the language always brought that.
They're still saying that.
that ancient up.
We do like to ask our guests what their favourite Irish word is. Would you actually have one, or is it crack?
I don't know. I don't really have one, to be honest.
That's fine. But I will say there's the Irish for having sex is Agbula Kraken.
Which is wonderful.
Which is absolutely wonderful. And yes, one of the big anti CRAIC arguments has been that CRAIC is in the 1977 dictionary for Irish, the O'Donnell right. dictionary, but it's not in Dineen.
And Dineen, of course, is the...
But Dineen, who'd have thought, like a grumpy Jesuit priest, maybe didn't include the word crack. He didn't include a few other words for, certain bodily functions.
Which
we presume happened. So.
Yeah, one would assume it was ongoing.
Yeah. But that's great. Donald Clark, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
So until the next time, it's a salon for me.
It's a salon for me.
And thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us for today's episode. Thank you for Donald for being such a great guest. Motherfucker Look comes out every Friday on the Headstuff Podcast Network. If you can't wait that long for your next podcast fix, consider one of Headstuff's other shows, such as Dubland, the podcast has come back. Thank you to Kirsten Shield for doing our art. Thank you to Brian for doing the production. Please rate Motherfucker 5 stars on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can contact the show at motherfuckerheadstuff.org. Join us next week. Come out every Friday. Salon.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Thanks, Brian.